U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Donald Trump starts December with a tariff blitz against Brazil and Argentina and threats against France. And he suggests a China trade deal may have to wait until 2021 in his second term. Plus, what happens next in the Democratic House drive to impeach President Trump? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with The Wall Street Journal. And here to discuss impeachment, which we always have with us, Bill McGurn. How are you, Bill?
Hey, Paul.
And Kim Strassel. How are you, Kim?
I'm well. How are you, Paul?
Excellent. Thank you. We should start. Well, let's start with the tariff issue, because while it may seem like a kind of a boring economic issue, it is in fact central to the president's political strategy and seems to be, and also part of a very, very important in how it affects the U.S. economy. And Donald Trump seemed to be heading towards what I would call a kind of trade equilibrium. He's trying to get the USMCA pact with Canada and Mexico passed in the Congress. He has been working towards a negotiation with China and has often sounded very optimistic about getting a deal. And he had taken his threats of tariffs against European cars off the table. And then suddenly, boom, he breaks free after Thanksgiving. Tariff man breaks free from his chains. That's how he has described himself, as tariff man. And is threatening to impose tariffs on Argentine and Brazilian steel, because he says they are manipulating their currencies, devaluing to get better trade terms. And he is threatening to retaliate against France for imposing taxes on U.S. giant tech companies. And to top it all off, Bill, he said that the China deal may have to wait till 2021. So is this, what's going on here? What is he thinking? This can't help the economy going into a re-election year.
Well, I think on China, it's his tactic, right, to make them, to squeeze them a little. And but it's a high wire act, because if they respond in kind, which they kind of have so far, it puts it off further. Look, I have a less benign view of tariffs than the president does, right? But the one thing he has going for him now in these dealings is that he's willing to impose them and absorb the costs, or actually have other Americans absorb the costs. So when he threatens them, people don't take them lightly. At this point, I would think that his priority should be getting the USMCA through and pressuring Mrs. Pelosi to do that, because I think that would be a big boost. The economy is doing well, but it's kind of languishing just above the 2% mark. And you just wonder if it's the China deal and the Mexico-Canadian deal, if those had been in place, would we be up in the 3% range? I mean, you can't guarantee that, but it does seem that would be the biggest factor.
A lot of economic studies, economists and at least one major economics study, Kim, that's suggesting that the trade uncertainty and the tariffs have taken about 1% off of GDP growth from that 3% we had for a while in the first and second year of the Trump administration, back down to 2%, which is basically where it was through most of the Obama term. And even in manufacturing, it's really in a recession. And that's affected job growth in a lot of the Midwest industrial states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, which I think is a danger for Trump's reelection. And so much of that manufacturing recession, I think, is, and it's a real recession. I mean, it's not expanding. It is contracting in a lot of parts of industry. And that is a risk for Trump.
And one of the best examples of how all of this is a downward circle actually is held there in these now proposed steel tariffs that he wants to impose on Brazil and Argentina. I mean, if you look, yeah, U.S. metal manufacturers have been having a pretty hard time. Steel prices have really plunged, especially since June. But that is mostly because, it's not because Brazil and Argentina are devaluing their currencies, et cetera. It's mostly because of a collapse in demand in the United States has been brought on, as you said, by economic uncertainty and what in essence is a sort of manufacturing recession. And that lack of demand has been brought on by manufacturers who are worried about what the tariffs mean and the future. And so they're pulling back from investing in the economy. So Donald Trump is now saying, I'm going to impose these tariffs on these countries and take care of all these things that I don't like they're doing. And I'll help U.S. farmers because Brazil and Argentina are replacing them in terms of economic or agricultural products going to China. But in the end, he's just further harming the economy and therefore giving himself yet more justification in the future to impose yet more remedies like this.
Well, and the steel tariff against Brazil is especially odd just on diplomatic grounds. Jair Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, they call him the Latin American Trump. He's made a show of trying to have good relations with President Trump. He's trying to reform his economy in significant ways with free market reforms on pension and taxes and labor markets. And the left doesn't like him. And Trump just basically gave him the back of his hand in this thing because steel tariffs are going to hurt Brazilian exports.
Yeah. And also the president gives two conflicting rationales for his use of tariffs and renegotiations. Sometimes what he says is, I just want you to treat our products and services the way we treat yours. And that's reasonable enough in it. Other times he seems to say, I want to reorient our economy to favor, tip the scale in favor of manufacturing and so forth. So it's never clear which of these he has in mind. I think the first is admirable. And if you really wanted to pursue the first, I think what you should be doing is pursuing a deal with Britain that they've talked about that could really help open up the global economy by giving Britain an alternative to the EU that is freer and fairer.
Well, and he may do that if Boris Johnson wins the British election.
But he should be talking it more, right? He tends to talk the negative. I'm going to impose tariffs on French wine and French cheese if you guys, tax Facebook and so forth. It'd be nice to talk more about. I don't know why he's not talking all the time about the deal that Mrs. Pelosi has before her now that she's just been dragging her heels on in this. I would be pushing for that because once in a while she gives a hint it could be imminent, but nothing gets done.
I think that, Kim, this reflects in part the tension inside the administration. You have Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, Larry Kudlow, Chief White House economic advisor, the economist in the White House saying, let's calm down, let's try to reduce uncertainty, let's make sure that we can get this economy growing as fast as we can through 2020, pull out of this recession in manufacturing, get back to growing in manufacturing. And Peter Navarro, the trade advisor, who plays directly to Trump's instincts. And Trump has called himself Tariff Man for a reason. He loves them. He thinks they're his household remedy. Call up a phrase that Joseph Schumpeter, the economist, used against Republicans in the 1920s. You had a problem? Let's put a tariff on it. You got another problem? Let's put a tariff on it. And Trump has done that now. He's doing this in the case of the French, threatening tariffs as a response to their taxes that they're imposing on American tech companies. I think the French are wrong in doing that. But again, Trump puts tariffs, which hurt American consumers, on those foreign goods.
Right. And in the process, showing just how far away in some ways the gulf is between the remedy he is proposing, these tariffs, and then the actual policy dispute at issue. And as you said, this is one of the worries, is that Donald Trump, anytime he has a disagreement with any foreign country over practically anything, his fallback is a tariff. When in fact, the question, for instance, you mentioned the French digital tax, that's a really complicated question. One that the French president, Emmanuel Macron, has not actually managed to convince even a number of other European players is a good idea. And yet we now have Donald Trump saying he's going to impose these taxes. And as a result, putting the Europeans in a situation where they may uniformly respond to him, even though they're not even that big of a fan of French tax policy on this particular area. And so he risks sort of courting almost a bigger response by picking out individual countries and disputes with them. He'd be much better off listening to that first set of advisors that you mentioned, because right now this is the number one question of his electability next year, is how the economy does. And the biggest leverage he has one way or the other on the economy is trade policy.
All right, Kim, well summed up. We are going to, after the break, we'll be talking about impeachment, and you're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Bill McGurn and Kim Strassel. And we have the post-Thanksgiving impeachment drive here in December. Looks like Democrats are poised to finally vote on impeachment. The Senate Intelligence Committee putting together its the report based on its two-week public hearings and several more weeks of secret hearings. In which they will presumably suggest a pattern of behavior by Donald Trump to the House Judiciary Committee, in which they will recommend, if not formal articles in specific language, they will essentially delineate, Kim, the pattern of behavior that they think warrants impeachment right now. We haven't seen this report. It hasn't been released publicly. Members of Congress could only get access to it on Monday night for the first time. And the House Intelligence Committee is supposed to vote on it today. We expect that it'll be a partisan vote right down the line. And then it goes to Judiciary, where Gerald Nadler is having a hearing on Wednesday with constitutional scholars about the impeachment. And it'll be discussion of whether or not, I assume, it'll be a discussion of whether or not these actions by the president qualify as impeachable offenses. Three Democratic witnesses, one Republican witness, and you can imagine where they'll come out on this. I guess the big question, Kim, is just how fast the Democrats will move. And whether or not they're going to put in four or five or more articles of impeachment. We know there are probably going to be two that are Ukraine-related, abuse of power, maybe extortion and bribery. And then there's going to be one on obstruction of Congress for resisting its subpoenas and so on. The question is, do they now go back and pull up old Robert Mueller and throw in the obstruction charge? And there's some Democrats who want an emoluments charge thrown in, too. That is, the claiming the president is violating the emoluments clause of the Constitution by not having fully separated from his ownership of his business. And let's have a kitchen sink impeachment. Throw it all in there.
Yet the speed is mind-boggling in and of itself. As you mentioned, the members of the Intelligence Committee are only getting access to this report Monday night and being asked to vote on it Tuesday. It's then being speedily shipped over to Jerry Nadler at the Judiciary Committee, where presumably even his own witnesses that are coming to speak tomorrow won't really have had time to have looked at the report, even if it's made public, and presumably are just going to get hit with a bunch of questions plucked out of this report that nobody has really had time to see or digest. Meantime, the White House was informed late last week that if they wanted to have someone present at this hearing, they didn't even know who was being called at that point, that they'd have to get on it and give a response immediately. The president had already been scheduled to be in NATO. That had been planned a year earlier. And so the White House legal counsel said, no, we're not even taking part in this farce. So, presumably what happens after this Judiciary Committee meeting is we have a discussion about which articles to hit the president with. There'll probably be a bribery and extortion one. There'll probably be one having to do with violating election laws. probably one in terms of obstruction of the Congress, and then maybe, as you said, even more, a whole kitchen sink of them, emoluments, obstruction of justice, and the Mueller probe, cheating on your taxes, you name it.
You think Stormy Daniels makes an appearance, Bill, here, the payoffs of Stormy Daniels?
I don't know. She could. I mean, it's a question. Look, I think part of the farce is we've known that they're going to impeach Donald Trump from the beginning, and a lot of the contradictions that you mentioned because of the timeline, they're not coincidental. I mean, Adam Schiff doesn't want people to examine the evidence too closely. He doesn't want to hear from the other witnesses. This is done on a timetable. They've decided to impeach Donald Trump to get it done before Christmas and have it to the Senate so they could presumably get it done before a lot of the senators running for office.
That is,
have the trial done in the Senate before this time. So it's sort of going to script. I think the president was right not to send his – why legitimize something that is not persuading the American people, or at least the marginal voters that the Democrats need to persuade. So it's just kind of a theater.
The question of the number of articles of impeachment, Kim, is at play here among Democrats, and there's varying arguments that you hear being made. One is, let's throw 5 or 6 at Trump because that captures the full magnitude, as Democrats put it, of his wrongdoing, and that the sheer weight of all of those actions will finally persuade the public that Trump should be impeached. The other argument for having multiple articles of impeachment is somewhat more, how should we say, cynical from some members who want to have a couple to vote against so that they can go back to the district and say, yes, I voted to impeach the president on Ukraine, for example, but I voted to acquit him on the collusion with Russia, say, or obstruction of justice. And that shows how even-handed I am. That's at least the calculation. I'm not sure that works with a lot of these members in Trump districts. I think they basically want to know, did you vote to impeach or not?
Yeah, and that's why what I'm hearing is that the vast majority of those moderates, as so-called moderates in these swing districts that are going to be very competitive next year, they've got an entirely different position, is let's keep this narrow. Let's keep it just a very specific number of articles on those issues in which we feel we have the best goods, the most compelling case, so that we can look as though we took this exercise soberly and carefully, et cetera. And then you even have, some members who at least privately, and I think at least one publicly, have floated the notion that maybe we ought to just step back and solely do a censure motion of the president. I find that unlikely to happen, having set the impeachment freight train barreling down the track. A lot of liberal heads would explode, including a lot of people in the media and a lot of people in the progressive base, if Democrats didn't ultimately hold an impeachment vote.
Yeah, Kim, I think I agree with you on the prospect of censure as an alternative, even if it would be the kind of safe harbor for some of the moderate Democrats. Most of the party really does want to brand Trump with the scarlet eye.
Yeah, and Paul, on that point, the interesting thing is, I think censure is out of the picture now because, Kim says, we've come so far down. You can't lead people up to impeachment and then pull out the rug from under them. But had they started with censure, it's interesting to contemplate they might have got a few Republican votes. And by contrast, what they're doing now, all they've done is unite the Republican Party in a way that I didn't think that they would be united. I mean, the vote against the inquiry was more bipartisan than the vote for it.
There are two Democrats
who voted on the Republican side. This is united Republicans, a lot of them who may not like Donald Trump and might have voted to censure him, didn't think the call was appropriate, but they're more outraged by Mrs. Pelosi and Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler and how they're rigging this game.
Well, we shall see how the debate proceeds as the public release, if there is in fact a public release of the Intelligence Committee report, and then the debate inside the Judiciary Committee over the articles of impeachment. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Kim. Thank you all for listening. We shall return tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.